Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I talked with Bob Gaffaro, who has been a cellist with the Philadelphia Orchestra since 1985. We talked about motivation and drive in music and in his battle beating MS.
Let's talk first, Bob, about you and the cello. What drew you to the cello in the first place?
I started the cello at the age of 9 in third grade in the public school. In those days, studying instruments was much more accessible than it is, unfortunately, today. They needed someone to play cello in the elementary school orchestra, so they said I could choose any instrument I wanted as long as it was the cello. So I picked the cello, and they thought it was a good choice.
That's great.
Yeah, it was something that just, you know, I took to it very naturally when I was very young. Picked it up very quickly for about the first year and a half, and then I kind of drifted away from it. You know, no one in my family played instruments, and my social setting was not conducive to classical music, and I actually picked up the guitar and got very serious about the guitar, and you know, I was self-taught, and I played lead guitar in several rock bands, and then I got interested in the cello again in high school, and I went to the School of Orchestral Studies in Saratoga, and that was where I first met Bill Stoking, and I took private lessons with him. That was a summer that changed my life, so that was a turnaround point, and I became what Robert Persig from Zen and the Order of Motorcycle Maintenance says, I became self-motivated, and you know, when a young person becomes self-motivated, there is no limit to what they are able to accomplish, so I see myself as a textbook example of someone who became very self-motivated. So.
And then you went to Juilliard?
Yeah, by some miracle, I got into the school, and I actually write about this in my book, but I got to school, and I was no doubt one of the worst cellists in the school, or should I say a novice-level cellist, and it was very demoralizing to go there. You know, Juilliard is a collection of small-town stars. You know, I'm sure Curtis is the same, but you know, it was so difficult when I was there, and at that point I had to find a better mousetrap, a way to, you know, catch up and get with the program very quickly, and, you know, I'm competing with all these kids that had given up their lives when I hadn't, so.
Wow, but you did.
Yeah, I did. I actually heard Yasha Heifetz play on a recording, and I had never heard string playing at that level, and I went and did a little reading up on Mr. Heifetz, and read what he said about, you know, practicing scales. So I went into my teacher my first year at Juilliard and said, okay, this is what I want to do. And I told him that I want to spend 3/4 of my time on scales. And he was reluctant, but he went along with it. And that's what I did. I basically spent the first 2 to 3 years at Juilliard on mostly scale work.
And that was because you wanted to kind of hone your skills?
Well, I had no choice, but this was what I had chosen to do, and you know, basically, if you're going to compete with these people, you've got to find a better way to do it and a much faster way to do it.
And then you were in the Baltimore Symphony?
Yeah, I was there for less than one season, then I got into Philadelphia in May of 1985. Yeah.
So this is 30 years in the Philadelphia Orchestra.
My 30th season. Yeah.
Wow.
Can't believe it, but here I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you've played with over 30 years with different conductors in Philadelphia. Can you talk about how the sound has changed, if it has?
Sure. You know, first of all, I came here in 1985, and I was hired in the middle of Riccardo Muti's 12-year tenure. And to me, Muti was just the ultimate in charisma. He could just sway an audience. He was so exciting as a conductor. And Savalas came in, and to me, he was the pinnacle of musical artistry. To me, there was no one that could touch his level of sheer musicianship. And then you had Eschenbach that came in, and to me, what a magician as a people person. You know, he just loved spending time with people here. And you know, I don't think a lot of people know this about Eschenbach, but when he was here in town, his schedule was booked 24/7 with a visit to Children's Hospital, a photo op with these donors, a meeting with this organization, you know, publicizing the orchestra for this purpose. That was all he did when he was here. And if you look at Yannick, I never thought this was possible, but you have a combination of all those characters in one package He has the charisma. He's got the musical preeminence. He's got the people person skills. It's all there. It's a complete package in every way. And the most important thing is he has the respect of all the musicians on stage, which is not easily attained. And it's funny because he has this very laid-back atmosphere. The musicians call him by his first name. There's no maestro. He doesn't come in with his cape and, you know, have his nose up in the air. But I think the number of times that he's told the orchestra to be quiet during rehearsal, I could probably count on one hand. That, to me, is indicative of that kind of respect that he commands here.
Over the years, you've always seemed to be exuberant and involved in a lot of things besides music.
Yeah, I actually got very, very involved in volunteer projects. It was something that was spurred on by a major health crisis. And at the end of 1998, I got the first symptoms of what would later on be multiple sclerosis. I started getting numbness in one leg. I started limping. You know, went to some doctors. They didn't know what it was. 3 months later, I started to lose vision in one eye. So when you have a numbness in one leg combined with a loss of vision in one eye, it becomes something of a textbook case of MS. I was, you know, did extensive testing. They found, ruled everything out, found lesions in my spinal cord. And then things really went downhill. In August of 1999, I was hospitalized for dehydration from motion sickness, but there was no motion. I was just, my whole central nervous system was up in smoke. I had over 50 lesions in my brain. I had a lesion in my spinal cord that was 3.5 centimeters long. I was unable to move my hands. I was legally blind. I was almost wheelchair bound, and I was told by the head of neuro-ophthalmology at Wills Eye Hospital that I'd be on permanent disability.
And it happened all within the space of several months?
Over 8 months. And the only thing I knew about multiple sclerosis was Jacqueline Dupre. You know, she was so brilliant, and, you know, she died from complications of the disease at the age of 42, and that was my only knowledge of the disease. And, you know, here I was in August of 1999, and when the doctor told me I would be on permanent disability, at that point, things changed because I decided I was not going to go down that road and I was not going to let this thing take over my life. So I started doing all my own research on fighting this disease and finding answers that had been overlooked by medicine and neurology. So I found all these clues, all these things that, you know, it's often said in life the best inventions and discoveries are the ones where people say, why didn't I think of that? And that's essentially what I did. I found a lot of obvious things that are overlooked.
I understand that you studied the lives or the experiences of other people who had done extraordinary things, from artists and musicians to people who had suffered severe trauma.
Absolutely. One of the highlights of my life was meeting Nando Parado, that he survived a situation, in a life-threatening situation that is really not survivable, and he did. In 1972, he was on a rugby team. They were flying from Montevideo, Uruguay to Santiago, Chile for a match. And they were in a chartered plane, and the pilot, for unknown reasons of error, brought the plane down for a landing in the middle of the Andes mountain range. And Nando was thrown in the crash from row 9 into the bulkhead. His skull was smashed in 4 places. He was in a coma. They had given him up for dead, put him in the cold, which incidentally saved his life. 72 days later, he showed up in the foothills of the Andes mountains. He had gone 37.5 miles through this mountain range. He had never seen snow before. He had no survival skills, no training. He had no equipment, no ropes, no boots, no ice axe, no tent, nothing. Anybody else would have died in that predicament, but yet he didn't. He did something that mountain climbing teams that later reconstructed his route said what he did was not possible. And to meet him, it was fascinating because I realized that he was one of my guides in doing something that was not possible, because MS is an incurable disease, yet I have completely cured myself of this disease.
And how have you done it?
Well, it's a combination of everything. It was all my own research of MS rates around the world associated with diet. It started with physical fitness. It changed everything as far as looking at clinical trials with the placebo group, how you get people who will inexplicably get better in a placebo group, where it's an anomaly to medicine and the medical field. And if you look at, you know, training the mind to learn those skills of how to make changes in the body, how to learn the secret of placebo group success, that's essentially what I've done.
So you changed your diet, your exercise, although you exercised a lot before this.
Yeah, but I modified. Everything was changed toward my new fight. I was not in a fight against an illness. I was in a fight for my life, and I wasn't going to lose this fight.
What do you think it was in you that caused you to have this strength and determination to not to give up, to fight?
Wow, I just feel like we have no idea what we're capable of until we're in a situation where our life is threatened with survival. And Nando, you know, in his speech here that he gave in 2013, he said that, you know, basically he's just a regular guy and he never thought of himself as possessing any special gifts or anything, very humble. And, you know, I never thought of myself as someone who could do something like that. But when I was faced with the end, it was, I wasn't going there. And I just decided that, you know, this thing was going to, it was not going to take me alive. I was going to devote every nanosecond of my life to beating this disease, and I did.
What was the role of volunteering in your recovery?
Basically, here I was in a situation where everything was stripped away, and I just decided that being immersed in self-pity was not going to help anything. So at that point, I decided to focus on helping others less fortunate, giving to the orchestra. I felt very, very grateful for the orchestra. They basically didn't say, okay, when can we replace you? When will your last day be? Or they said, oh, take all the time you need. And they were so great about it. And I will forever be grateful in that sense, the way I was treated by the musicians, by the staff.
So now you're back playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra, 30-year anniversary, and you're writing a book.
Right. I'm almost done with the book, so.
Well, congratulations. Well,
thank you so much. It's always great to see you, Susan.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.